toutes tes fautes.
Welcome to a new episode of With Open Mouths, the podcast. I'm your host, Carnita Lilla. Today, I am overjoyed to be talking to artist Jager Deliska. I first met Jager during Emancipation Day events in Kingston in 2023. Jager was the on-site portrait painter, and I was bowled over by this joyful soul who drew people with his calm spirit and painted with such inspiration, regardless of the monsoon-level rain. Today, Jager is evolving as an artist and sees himself as much more than a portrait painter. We speak to him about how his creative practice undermines harmful masculine stereotypes, what it means to find inspiration through community, and also what it means to transform your home into an art gallery.
Amazing. We have landed.
Let's go, Mission Control.
Wow. Thank you so much, Jager, for agreeing to talk to me today.
I'm happy to be here.
After all of that, thank you so much. I'd like to talk about what led you to painting as a creative practice, and like way back, what kind of child were you?
Mm-hmm. This is a great question. I've thought a lot about it. I usually say when I got into the medium of painting, it was during the pandemic. It was during that time where we're still in a pandemic, but during that initial isolation period, where I wasn't seeing a lot of peers, I lost my job, and we were just all kind of in this standstill moment. I started painting it just seemed like the most natural thing to do. And I have spent I do have some form of arts training. I just never painted like this, never so seriously. It was always more a drawer, sketcher, conversationalist kind of artist, as opposed to actually making things. But yeah, portraiture just made sense at the time. It was really healing to see faces and meditate on them. Mm. But when I really think about it, I've been doing, I've had an art practice a while, I probably wouldn't call it that time, for a while now. And a lot of it was based on collaboration. And for example, one of my first major art projects was with the Carefree Black Boy Project, an organization I started to explore the idea of Black masculinity and do some arts programming around it. And I would lead this team, me and my friends, and we were in high school at the time, where we'd go to people's houses, we'll take their photos, like Black men in our community, and we'd ask them personal questions and capture this great photo of them. It was almost like a Humans of New York kind of feel. Mm-mm-mm-mm. And that really opened my eyes. I think that's actually when I first got into portraiture, even if I wasn't the one taking it. And painting just gave me more ownership and gave me more of a personal risk to say, I'm actually investing myself into the process as well. That was really, felt really crucial.
Mm. Yeah. So I kind of moved from photographs, seeing the photographs and thinking about what the photographer wanted to capture, to thinking about how you could capture that through painting in a different kind of, in a subtle way, you know?
Yes. And you know what? Actually, I would add to that, because it's both yes and no. I'm realizing now that the portrait is, and I do a lot of, I have a lot of set sessions where I invite someone to sit with me. I take their photos and paint from life sometimes. And I absolutely enjoy those sessions that I'm there with the model and I'm talking and engaging and asking them about their life, how they view love and all these other intimate topics. What I realize is that I don't know, the paintings are kind of like receipts. It's like receipts of the conversations that we had. And it almost feels like the, so you say, almost like the least important part, or like, let me not say that. It feels like a receipt of the conversation, like what we actually had in that moment, that intimate exchange of conversation of asking questions that either no one ever thought to ask. It feels so sacred, and these paintings are kind of like pure meditations on that, and maybe someone else can derive what the connection is between me, the painter, and the sitter there. But yeah.
I mean, I saw that like during Emancipation Day when you were here and you were doing live paintings. It takes you a long time, or not a long time, but it takes you time to establish a rapport with the sitter, like much more so than actually, it's much more that than it is about laying paint onto the canvas or to the paper, you know, and that kind of starts bringing out the personal quality, you know, of the painting itself. So I think that's what you mean when you say that it's like a kind of receipt of that interaction.
Yes, exactly. No, it's exactly that. It's really, you know, building rapport, and then the painting being informed by that, and almost the soul being attached to that. Like, I'm like, I'm not just painting and I'm not just rendering. I also want to capture something that feels very human and offer it. That's also respectful of that individual and our conversation. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, when people like stand in line, or probably even in your studio, their first impression is kind of usually like people look at what you've done and they think, like, does this look like me? Like, is this like faithful to what I look like? Usually. But with your work, people have a different, they're like, does it capture something of me? You know? And that's what they always kind of are drawn to, you know, that feeling of this feels like me.
Yeah. And I want to add on to, actually, I didn't answer that second part of your question about what kind of child I was. And to give you some background, I'm the youngest of six boys. I grew up with five older brothers. And like every child, I grew up with almost an insatiable desire for love and affection and care. And I give all credit to my brothers, but I feel like they did have difficulties handling that, or like trying to be a loving figure without having the practice of rendering loving acts. And so I think I found myself as a child like really wanting attention in the purest ways. Well, hey, attention to get attention, I feel like it's still, children need attention, they need care, they need affection, they need to be seen. And a lot of my work, I feel like I want to recognize the person who's in front of me and give them what it felt like to, give what my younger self would have wanted, to be seen, to be cared for just as I am at that moment. I think it's a really powerful activity or process that renders both of those people more complete after. Yeah.
It's like a necessity. I remember like a young girl queuing for a long time to have her portrait like painted. It was raining. It was sopping wet, like sopping. We were drenched. And this young girl, maybe 6 or 7 years old, was wrapped, like her parents had wrapped her up in different kind of little blankets that they, you know, that nobody expected the rain to be like that. Eventually, like after a long time, she got her spot, you know, and she sat on that chair like wrapped up, And like, seriously, like, my impression was like, wow, like, finally, you know, she got that seat. And it was precious to her, like, what you gave her, that attention, you know. And I think it's so much more, like what you said, it's so much more than the act of painting. It's, you know, you're seeing, and you are, you're elevating, and you're seeing, and you're saying, this is precious and beautiful, you know. And I think, like, so many people, like, children growing up just lack that, you know, they lack being seen.
No, I really, and honestly, that really touches me. And I thank you for saying that. I feel so much tenderness, both in, like, you know, a beautiful way, but like tender as an emotional around my youth, around my younger years as a child, just feeling like really wanting to be seen, or really, I don't know. I did see a lot of myself in media that did not look anything like my story. It looked so aggressive. And I grew up in Florida, and it's really important for the context of how hyper-masculine the culture was. I, at the time, didn't know, but I was growing up in a queer experience in a space that was just so hyper-masculine, but also under a lot of stress of political social stress around immigrants at the time. Well, so continues. It was just a really stressful pressure cooker, and humanity's, I don't want to say that, like, let's say survival was at the forefront, and everything else kind of took a backdrop. And even now, I have this daily painting practice, and it, you know, around me, it feels like the world is burning, and there's all these things that require my attention. But for some reason, I feel like it is, like, vitally important that I take this time, 4 hours a day, to try to render an image, to like, essentially, like, meditate on this and bear witness to the stories around me, to the people I'm engaging with, that I inherited a lot of love, but a lot of challenges, and our story isn't done being told yet. And, like, I'm still part of that. So I feel very, you know, empowered by all this. It's definitely emotion inducing, and I just love that I have a practice that allows me to tap into that. I think it's probably the biggest reward I've gotten from having a painting practice, is being able to engage with emotions, something I felt like was denied to me for a long time, growing up in a masculine, like, racialized body. And I'm really touched by all of
it. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, as much as you see your sitters, like, your practice is also about, I see, like, I'm the artist, I see, and this is how I see, you know, and that is what makes it very special, because it comes from your heart, and not your hands. And like, since we're on, like, the, like, subject of your portraits, could you, like, describe one of your paintings for listeners who haven't seen your work?
We can. And I was thinking I was going to share, and this is really going to test. I've taken some art, fine art, art history courses, art theory courses. I'm getting better at talking about art. This is going to test. I think the painting that I will talk about be one of my favorites recently. It's I Can Feel You Watching Me. And let's see if I pull that up. Okay. All right. So shall we just focus on, like, describing it? And I can also send you the image, so
yes,
it'll be in your show notes. So I Can Feel You Watching Me depicts a figure that's taking up about 2/3 of the image there. It's done in gouache, and it is of a figure who is turned away from the viewer. They have their they're turned away from the viewer. They have waves, which is I'm realizing a lot of people don't know what that is that are outside of the like Black experience. Waves are just when your hair is like you groom it so often that it just waves against the scalp of your hair. So we're seeing this feature, this figure has waves. He's looking away. You can't see his eyes. You're just seeing mostly his ear and his musculature of his collarbone and shoulder muscles are really pronounced. They're painted in a kind of lushy slash brutalist way. And when I see brutalist, I feel like you can see this, say, the strokes. It's a very painterly, I'm a very painterly painter. It's a very painterly rendering. And yeah, you're seeing a lot of texture. I'm actually noticing that a lot of like, I use gouache, acrylic gouache for this painting in particular. And it has a way of like unifying the color of like a flat brightness, kind of like, almost like a slightest bit of ash on top of the painting, but it's very vibrant. Actually, yeah.
So when you say painterly, like what do you mean when you say that?
You can see the painting is being rendered through a series of strokes as opposed to like a unified realism kind of like smooth
slickness. Yes, there isn't like a slickness. They're kind of multiple washes and you can see all the layers.
Exactly, yes. It's a lot of flat, almost sketchy. So I guess I still am a sketch artist. A sketchy kind of, I'm strong with paint. And it's different from that, like rendering shapes with slow transition through values. I'm really just sketching in with a variation of values to produce this almost moving idea of what skin would look like, you know? Like it's really slightly abstract, very stylized. I do love stylized things. And yeah.
So could you tell us a bit about the sitter?
Yes. This is the first time in a while and that I didn't use a full-on sitter. It was based off a reference of waves. I was trying to do a show 4 years back of just centered around waves and male grooming, Black male grooming particularly. And this was my favorite reference point from that. And I've been trying to do this thing where some of the cons working with a sitter is that, like we were saying, I get really attached to their story. I'm really precious. I'm like, okay, they've told me a lot and I almost want to paint in a way or like talk about in a way that doesn't reveal what I worked and what we both worked on together to achieve. So I've been introducing more reference images that you can either can't see the whole figure or that I'm not attached to sort of play around with the stylature a little bit more. I'm very careful of I mostly paint men. And I'm very mindful of my positionality, my identity, and I, as a queer man, and I almost want to, I'm always conscious about the lens of which I'm painting from. I never want to infringe on someone. Like if I want to express my sensuality or sexuality, I'm very careful of not like infringing that onto the sitter that's not the relationship in which we share. So this helps is when I don't know the figure and their face is not fully in the image. I'm like, okay, this, I can add more sensuality in there and play more.
Yeah, it is interesting. It's really interesting. So you kind of like play with a paint instead of with like the body, or instead of like with a sexuality. You kind of, you know, find ways of being respectful, I think. I think that's what it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, respecting the person's autonomy.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. So that was great. But I think, you know, what's really interesting for me, like when I met you, was that at that time, which was last year, you hadn't started art school yet.
Yeah.
So currently you're at art school at Concordia and you're doing a BFA. But before that, you were working in many community-centered roles. Could you talk a bit about how your life has changed in the past year?
School has a lot to offer.
I was like, I want to talk to you about this, like when you, like after being there for a year, because when I spoke to you, you were like, so, wow, this is going to be amazing. I can't believe I'm going to be painting full time finally.
Yeah. And honestly, here's what I'll say. The things I'm definitely taking away from this first year is the amount of like academic reflection and rigor that comes with presenting art or perceiving art that I just didn't have access to before. But I will also say that, I was a community-based artist for a long time. I did a lot of work within communities, almost 10 years or so, doing art programming, doing workshops within my community. And there is just so much learning that comes from that. I think like the foundation of what I do really just centers around collaboration and working with people. So that is like the best lessons in terms of like how to exist as an emotional being. School was challenging. It was challenging to have all these ideas of like, oh, maybe my work should be a little bit more concise. It should explain this particular, like, I know I'm constantly talking about masculinity. Maybe I should have this more academic way of like approaching that. And I've been able to research a lot, like Isaac Julian and a whole bunch of artists through our library, which is really awesome. But it has given me, I'm in this place of, I don't want to say doubt, let's say curiosity. I don't know where, I don't know if painting is going to be my main thing anymore. I know I want to make portraits, but I'm not sure if a portrait requires just painting. You know, it can be so many other things. And I feel like I'm like, whoa, I'm at the start again, which is a great thing to feel, honestly. But also a frightening thing to feel. Especially, I had my first international show this year while I was doing kind of this. So this is like crisis of like, okay, what kind of artist I want to be? And I'm really proud of myself. I had my first show in London, in the UK. It was awesome. I had three of my paintings up there. But it was also weird to feel the paintings I had up there were more me before school, or before, let's say, before I started asking these questions about like, how can I expand my practice? In school, I did a lot of performance art. Didn't think I would do that. I did a lot of performance art. I did a lot of sculpture. And I felt this like intense need to like pull people into my story and not just have them look at something, but like have a somatic approach to the work that I'm making. Because it is deeply felt. And yeah, so it was, it feels like everything's starting again. It's kind of chaos that first year. I also left a job, an art space job I had for the last 4 years. So when I tell you, yeah, it's been a bit of a hurricane.
It sounds like it. It sounds like a hurricane, but it feels like it's something that you needed to go through to kind of see the possibilities. And I can imagine that it was terrifying because, you know, it took all this time for you to realize that, you know, this suits me. I like this. This practice suits me. And suddenly it's kind of like, but look at all of this, you know, and is this, do you always want people to look at your, to see you and think of a particular style, you know, a particular type of thing? So I can imagine that it was hectic, but it sounds like it was fruitful, you know?
Definitely. I've learned a lot of new skills. I've been working with plaster a lot. I've gone into woodworking. And particularly that class that I did, performance art, it was called ArtX at Concordia, where it's all about the process of making art, where we thought more about installation and what we wanted the viewer to experience. It was really, really helpful for me as someone who is like, I create a lot of work with feeling, and a part of a lot of my art practice is for my own self, like my mental wellness. It helps a lot with that. But now I'm thinking that other part of like using my empathy to think of the person who hasn't had this long dance with the arts, maybe feel like it is not their cup of tea, and like say, you know what, actually, I think the art that you've been looking at hasn't spoken to you or your story and has spoken around that. And I'm like, you know what, I actually have all these people that I can tell our stories, these emotional and great things that we share, these epiphanies, and be like, you know what, this is also a thing that could be presented and shared, and it could center our stories as well. So, so it's a good tool.
Yeah. So would you say it's kind of, you are now less Jager the painter and more Jager the artist, like on a journey to being like the artist?
Yes. And even it's interesting. Yes, I would say that because I just got, I've been working on my new artist statement with a writer for the last 3 months. And we kept going back and forth, like, what am I going to call myself? I've fixed on portrait artists because I love working with people with faces. I don't think you just need a painting to make a face or to render portraits. And I'm an artist. Like, I feel like those right now, that makes the most sense for where I'm at right now. And so, yeah, there has been a transition. It's more than just a painter, but an artist, a portrait artist.
Awesome. Beautiful. That's beautiful. And I think, you know, you're definitely your painting, and you mentioned it before, you know, about stories and about stories that people would be responsive to. And it doesn't only have to be in the form of portraiture. And I think, you know, before you came into art school, you were working a lot with communities. How do you see and think of yourself as an artist being a community builder? How has your work in the past helped to build communities?
That's a great question, and I've been thinking about that a lot. So I was there a little before. I did leave my job of 4 years where I was basically like a program coordinator for youth. And it was an amazing job for those like first few years. But I came to that job with a lot of anxieties. I felt like this is going to be my chance to be like, you know, get a real 9-to-5, like a proper stable income. but it was also a not-for-profit, and it's, you know, a lot of people go through, a lot of artists, they go through this not-for-profit burnout where I started to realize, well, I departed from that job because me and my executive team had different ideas about what it required. Like, some felt that I was like too emotionally invested or too emotional when it comes to that job and like I was really into informed consent. I just felt like, oh my gosh, I know we have to get these granting bodies and we have to follow these particular things, but people shouldn't, I don't know. It was started to, my morals, my own principles started to get compromised in the that form of community building. And honestly, it really wounded me when I left. I just felt like, oh my gosh, the thing that I've invested so much time in and the people and communities I'm attached to, I felt like I was letting them down. But I've been in many conversations with them. And they were here for the individual. We aren't institutions, we are individual people, we're individual artists. And it's been a great reminder for me to be like, you know what? Me, myself, I can create a space and be a community builder, whether that's having apartment art shows or even at school. A lot of my training and work with youth, a lot of my peers have a lot of defeatist attitudes around art making or being an artist in this field before even trying. And when I first started, a peer of mine, another artist, just told me, you know, you really should share as much information as you can with your fellow students. And I have been. We've been able to like have a more realistic expectation on what it feels like to be an artist and to live off your work. And that it isn't just like this hopeless endeavor. It's a thing that is, there's the art making, there's the more business side, the sales of it. These are separate domains, and we can get good at any of those things. Like, it really is a thing that we can improve at. And behind all of those doubts and those defeatist attitudes is really more our inner emotional state. And I've learned so much about that through my peer mentoring job. Like, you know, a lot of the things that we say is the core issue, whether it's like, you know, the world hates artists, this is not sustainable. Sometimes that says a lot more about what we feel about ourselves and what we're doing and why we might be sabotaging the things that we're doing. So,
I think maybe also on a practical level, Jager, it's just that people don't know. They don't know what it takes. They think that art is something that is on the wall of a gallery, and who's buying that stuff? Who's looking at that stuff? You know, those like very practical things. So to actually say, well, you need to designate so many hours a day to actually producing, number one, you need to be talking to other artists. You need to be going to see what's on the walls of institutions. You need to be thinking about where your thing fits in, and then looking at like ways to sell things, talk to, you know, those kind of people have no idea when they come from a background where they've never, ever been exposed to it. You know, and obviously there's like a deep sense of being an imposter. Of course you are. If you are born in this color skin, you are an imposter. If you don't come from this place, you are an imposter. You know, so there's a lot of kind of very basic kind of ground level work that needs to get done for people to actually start producing and doing these things.
To that point, that imposter point, something that I've been changing my perspective on to deal with this, you know, imposter syndrome, is thinking about how much art like I viewed and digested that took me to start painting, that took me to do anything. It takes an incredible amount of love and attention, and also other artists doing their thing to get other artists to start. It really does take so much energy and so much other effort. Like, we work in a very communal effort. And so when I started really sitting with that and thinking about like, wow, this really is a communal affair. I'm also part of that. There's people who are looking at the work that I do, whether it might be that little girl, for example, or or many of the other people reach out to me and they feel touched by it. And I'm hoping, and I know that I am only one artist attached to all these other artists who's going to start inspiring them to move whatever direction they want to, but ultimately to achieve self-actualization. Like, it's an incredible privilege to work in a community of artists, and we all do, one way or the other. And acknowledging how much love goes into that, I think it really helped me realize, okay, yeah, this is the same way I wanted. I like deeply craved for like, particularly queer Black artists growing up, and how many times I would see them and be so inspired. And now I'm part of that. People are also craving to see the work that I do.
And I think, you know, remembering that is important, like for you as you, on your art school journey, which is a harrowing journey, you know, you need to remember that. Like, you do not need that institution. You don't need them. You're using it to get better, but you're already established. You've got people, you've got your community. You know, I think that's really important for you to remember. I'm just kind of thinking of myself too. So, you know, so like you were talking about your interest as processing heteronormative male emotional blindness. This heteronormative male emotional blindness, can you talk to me about that, please?
Yes. Yeah. It's one of the keywords in my practice. And what I say that is normative male alexithymia.
I couldn't pronounce that. So I kind of looked up that word and I found it to mean male emotional blindness.
Yes. It was such a life-changing experience to come across that term to describe something that I feel like my brothers and myself have been facing, where just imagine how many problems occurs when someone doesn't understand the internal workings of themselves, and in turn also someone else's internal workings. I've been in my conversations with the people I've sat with, many of the men that I've sat with, I hear similar stories of where they genuinely are perceiving an experience totally different from whether it be their romantic partner, their siblings. And it's I'm a queer man, so unfortunately I've been able to exist in outside of this binary of like a just women's spaces, just male spaces, just being able to exist in all that curiosity. I've been able to see like a lot of both sides or the nuance between those two, where I'm like, yeah, no, I can see why your partner was very upset that you didn't do so. And so like, it felt like when we are unable to see these things and to process these things, it is a very scary way to live life. Like, it is actually detrimental to our abilities to create friendships, strong connections, and like friendships that are really profound, that aren't just like, hey, well, how are you doing? Like, we hang out with each other and we share much words. And there is great benefits to having, you know, a friendship where most of it's through somatic approaches. Like, you just you go on walks, for example, or just something that's more not everyone's emotionally literate or able to like communicate everything through words. And there's a really great benefit to like literally somatic approaches, but there's a great benefit to being able to express and really, really communicate your emotions. I think this is most present in like when we communicate our disappointment, because disappointment is such an incredible emotion. It literally tells us, it offers us a chance to get closer to someone else. If we are feeling disappointed in a partner, in a friend, I've been learning that it's so okay to just say, like, you know what, I'm actually disappointed that you didn't show up when you said you would.
That is hardcore. What you just said That is hardcore. Because it's reflective, like not only of that emotion, but of your own state.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, like I'm disappointed that you hurt me. I'm disappointed that you did this to me. I'm disappointed, you know, it's like you saying that I value myself enough to be able to tell you this, but also it's got this judgment, you know, on the person that maybe like I feel that you didn't live up to what like my expectations. That's like hardcore.
But I will also say, okay, it is in one part, you know, you are standing up for yourself, and it's a place to like appreciate your self-worth, but you're also at the same time offering a chance to that person who has disappointed you to be informed about what's going on in your relationship, like what's
and what how you feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It gives that person the opportunity to respond to something as opposed to being, I'm fine, it's fine, it's totally fine. Like, I would see this happen a lot with my male friends, where we were just so quick to throw things on the rug, but the rug was actually getting quite bumpy. You're like, no, we actually have to deal with this massive mess that we just sweeped under there. You're being resentful now. And if you have a lot of time, you're unable to recognize these emotional cues, you would not be able to recognize what's sparking your anger. You won't be able to recognize, actually, you just pointed me 7 months ago, or in pinpoint, you know, you don't have the ability to lay that all out. So it is such a vital, like, we're social beings, we have these emotions for a reason. It helps us build community, helps us be accountable to each other. And that gets harder and harder as we get more virtual identities and like all these other eyes on us. It's really crucial that in our most interpersonal relationships that we're able to express disappointment. And it doesn't have to be an end. I feel like literally if it is an end, it's
then it's the end, really. Then there was not much there.
Yeah.
You know, like if it is the end, hopefully it can be the beginning of something. What led you, like in your life, to start thinking specifically about male emotional blindness?
Yeah, it was definitely my five older brothers.
Oh, your brothers. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wow, that must have been hectic.
Yes, definitely had to. But it's also so bewildering. Like, I grew up with them as children, obviously. and imagine, like, the sweetest young boys who are just, you know, affectionate. They show a lot of care and attention. And then suddenly, like, around 12, 10, they don't just, like, that young boy dies and they're immediately indoctrinated with this hyper-aggressive exterior in order to survive in that particular space. It was such a weird thing to see as a child, not understanding the context behind it and like what this sudden shift is. And when they're children, we always think everything's our fault. So just seeing all of them like, oh, one, two, three, four, like every single one of them would do it almost like clockwork. Their humanity would just be immediately pushed down, contained, and then we're fighting a lot, and we have to constantly perform. Like it was one of those things where you just constantly have to keep performing. That was such a scary experience for me, and I wasn't when I got around that age, and I wasn't able to keep up, like or whatever, but I wasn't able to do the same thing or like be less emotionally reserved.
Vacant.
Mm. Yeah. Like it was quite a challenge. So yeah, I don't know. It was really just seeing that and thinking like, wow, there is something here that I feel like no one has taught me how to deal with, and that many people are still doing and continue with today. And worse than that, I feel the risk of having men who aren't holistic, who aren't raised to be holistic, is dangerous. Like, it is quite, it feels almost vital that this violence that I grew up with, it seems so normal for this, you know, boys will be boys, or they will just like fight around and whatever. They had like shorter lifespans. Like, they were, I grew up in West Palm Beach, in a particular neighborhood where like they were dying quite quickly. Like, it was, and we were just getting used to it. It felt so wild. I don't know. I think, yeah, that experience was like, well, this can't be normal. This, I don't think civilization would have continued if people were constantly killing each other like this. It was a lot. It was a lot. So that's really what sparked that.
And that it's reflective of, excuse me, like a trend. It's you know, it's not just your community, you know, it's a lot of communities, you know, where young boys from like a early age are kind of socially groomed to, you know, carry this kind of hyper masculinity that's backbreaking and very it's a painful thing. Yeah. So I think, you know, just kind of moving from the community, the broader community, into your own space, like into your own space with your own practice, you did something that for me is a very curious thing, because I'm a curator, and I like to think of my home space as being separate from my workspace, but you opened up your apartment for something called Find What Shames You.
Yes.
What inspired you to open up your home in this way?
Right.
And
yes.
Like, what, like that title? Oh my God. Like,
yeah, it was awesome. So Final Shames was actually my second show in my apartment, actually third technically. My first one was Rear View. First, like my first show at my apartment, it was a birthday celebration. It was a one night event where I felt like, hey, let's do this. I am preparing to do my first art fair, and this is going to put more pressure on me. But we also had an artist talk. We had, you know, we had desserts and food for people. They all came through, and it was such a powerful night. And I was like, okay, no, I have to do that again. Jeez. So, like, you know, going through my first year of high school, working three jobs, being stressed out and preparing for my first international show, I was like, this would be a great time to have another apartment show.
Yes.
Final Shames You. And really with that show, I was learning so much about the effects of chronic shame. And this was more targeted toward myself. Like, a lot
what
of
what does that word even mean, Jager? What does like chronic shame
mean? Yeah, people who live with this long identity of shame, of being shameful of their, who they are, their personhood. I think, you know, as a queer person, many people exist in this state of constant shame about who they are, where they start working harder to overcome their queerness, and, you know, I'm going to be the best painter, the best whatever. I'm going to engage in these kind of celebratory activities or things that might be, that gives a lot of attention on me and takes away from the things that shames me. Shame, slight. Shame is such an incredible emotion. It is like the main, like the biggest
yeah.
loss.
I know. I mean, like, if I'm sorry, like, if you just think about all the, you know, despots, all these people that do like the most horrific, awful things, and you just think about the shame they carry, you know, and how they've normalized that, it's just horrific. So, like, that emotion, that kind of state of mind is just harrowing to kind of contemplate.
Yes. And yeah, no, truly. And something that's incredible about the property of shame is that it's an emotion that can get you to think something else is the problem. Like, for example, I would be loved more if I'm more beautiful, if I was better groomed. Like, shame will tell you, okay, once you fix this thing, you're good. You fix it, you do the whole thing, don't feel horrible. Or in my example, especially being in contrast to you, my brothers, who are a little bit more rambunctious. If I'm a perfect child, the perfect son, I'm so nice, I'm going to be loved more, my life will be better, and everyone around me will be happy. I do those things. I try to do these things.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, just created more shame. Like, I was like, why? Especially something like good is a hard thing to measure. So you're thinking, like, no, I can have to be better. Do all this sort of stuff. So the show Find What Shames You was really for me to look at myself, look at the things that's brought me here, and just appreciate it and love it. And actually, it comes from a whole quote from this from Raheem, and I'll send you a show notes as well. And he says, find what shames you and love it to death. So that's the whole thing there. And really, yeah, bear witness to it, love as much of it as you can, and then perhaps through that process, you gain a better sense of self. And I love doing that with a group of people. Like, this place was packed. There was like over 40 people who showed up. I was like, gosh. Yeah, catering, I paid a curator to curate. I also paid an artist, someone to interview. It was wonderful. Loved it. It was, I recommend.
Yeah, and you kind of, perhaps you see the things that are valuable in you know, that experience instead of focusing on your anxieties around it. So your anxieties of not finishing the work that you meant to, you know, those kinds of things. So like on your website, referring to the show, you were talking about the process of painting on to such a tight deadline, but that you eventually made peace with this process. How do you like balance your own expectations of your work with like a practice that is healthy, you know, and sustainable?
That's a good question. Let me say, okay, how
like,
I do.
In other words, like, how do you stop giving yourself such a hard time being the perfectionist that you are?
Honestly, for me, it's through love. Like, it's through love of the medium and, like, the skill. Like, I have multiple approaches to start. Part of my art practice deals with my emotional being and emotional wellness. And that is separate from, usually, actually, my painting practice that I know that I'm going. I do have more of a business mindset because I kind of have to save myself. Or at least the different kinds of paintings. And then the studies is what I love. The studies is just me trying to acquire a skill and get better at it that I just enjoy it so much. And now with the school thing, I've learned so much about the conceptual ideas that I want to realize as opposed to just like painting to paint. I'm like, oh, actually, I just want to get this particular thing out. Like, I want the viewer to latch onto this, and that's the core of it. With the art show, I saw it more as a performance piece. I saw them coming to my apartment, looking around things, and like, this is where everything's made. You're seeing my kitchen, you're seeing how I carry myself, you're seeing all my my bed and all my furniture pushed through. Like, you're seeing all these things. This is all a portrait of me. So inviting people into that process and asking them to believe something, to believe this apartment is a gallery. That we're going to have signs everywhere, and you're going to, there's going to be an artist statement, we have a curator, and you're going to believe that, and you're going to act in that way. It was just so interesting to see people, like, instantly they get their glass of wine, and they just, like, they're engaging, they're having these insightful conversations around shame that I felt like wouldn't have been so readily available amongst that big of a group unless it was at an art show like setting. So loved it.
And it just opens up like things in a totally different way. Like, I'm thinking, you know, how would this look if I did something like this? You know, and the first thing I would think of is like making sure that like my drawers are in order, because they are a complete chaotic mess. Like, actually, you know, like my closets are, they basically held together by the doors. They have a life of their own. That's where my mind goes. Like, all the, and like, if you think of like the emotional like center of the home, it's all the places you don't see.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Yeah. I was in my head, I kept telling myself, hey, you're an artist, brand yourself as an artist. People don't think they're these super tiny people. It'll be fine. Well, yeah, I had two people with me that day, and we were cleaning everything so aggressively. We're like, Belle, some of you are about to be in the space we need. But yeah, that was a little stressful.
You know, like something that you wrote when you were talking, like thinking about Find What Chains You, is that this show captured everything that you loved about working with community art programming, where art isn't something distant, but it's tangible, and that it invites people like viewers to think that they can do it too. And what I loved is that you said, because art is and always will be for the people. That really, really touched me and really spoke to me. But like, I wondered specifically in your case, what circumstances or people inspired you to feel this way about art?
Wow. You know, yeah, honestly, I have a sea of people who see my experiences, and I'll just pick out a few that really were quite pivotal to me. First, I'm just going to get another drink of water. Right. First, I have to give credit to when I was 16, I started going to a monthly open mic, or actually a weekly open mic called Rise. It was in Scarborough, and it was incredible. Like, I started volunteering there after seeing just the right community of people. A lot of people similar to my age, I'd say you can get anywhere from like 15 to 35, and they would come every Monday. And you'd have these people come up to the open mic and just share their story, share a poem. And no matter what, people were clapping or snapping. And it wasn't out of a need to like appease the person, but more of like, you know what, I hear you, I've seen you, I'm witnessing something. I'm witnessing this. And it was just so awesome. So yeah, I started volunteering there, and I would be there every Monday for like 2 years. right up until the end of high school for me. And I started seeing people who I knew from that open mic on the streets, waving hello, and like suddenly feeling way more attached to the community of Scarborough. And imagine, I love this because especially for the men that I met there, I would have been, like, I have a lot of fear. If I saw them on the street, I think I would have been, like, frightened. I would consider, like, not frightened. Let's say I'm just being prepped in case anything happens, you know, whereas...
Yes, yes. So you kind of walk with, like, a natural kind of awareness and tightness and, you know...
Yes. And I know that they're doing the same thing.
Yes.
And then so to see them after this person, you'd see this person who just shared this incredible poem about a breakup that really affected them. This, like, and you see them on the street randomly with his boys, and you're like, wow. And you're sharing a genuine smile of like recognizing that person outside of that space. And it felt so impactful. I was just so grateful for that whole experience. And that experience led me to creating Care for Black Boy Project, which is that art-based project where we did that photo essay. And again, I was asking all these questions around Black masculinity with Black men in my area. And we actually went all across Toronto, and they invited us into their homes, and they would answer these questions like no one has ever asked them. How do they feel like, how do they want to be loved? What are their most important relationships? And they were just so forthcoming. And imagine for someone like me who, I would actually say that I had a pretty intense fear of men, like an irrational, almost phobia level intense fear of men.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, like, coming from five brothers where people were getting killed, like young men were getting killed, that was like totally rational. It was like, you know, like completely, completely rational. You know, that is so interesting that you as like a young Black man are, you know, you're going to, like, that must have like been a total, like, made, you know, you get have this like real shift, you know, in perspective, you yes. know, especially like with not only your peers. I mean, that's one thing, but like definitely elders, you know?
Yes. It was, oh my gosh, it was good. It was really, I was so grateful because it raised my capacity for love and like care for other people to the point where like I would get disappointed in some sections where I felt like, okay, this is really healing the ideas and parts of me that is, that identify as a Black man and, my masculinity, all that sort of stuff. That first rise was incredible for that. And as I was ending high school, I felt this need. I really wanted to explore my sexuality more, and I felt like that space had limitations there. And these are all grassroots organizations, so I don't, you know, blame them for not being able to swear on every particular theory. But I started feeling that push, and that drew me more towards downtown Toronto. I was trying to engage in the arts programming there to fulfill that part of identity. Then it also came out of like, it was hard to find a place where I can do all these things at once. Mm-hmm. Like, I can, a Black man, I can explore my sexuality and exist in like a human environment, which is why I created the Care for Black Boy Project. I was like, okay, well, I want to start finding the nuance in this experience that we're sharing. Mm-hmm. So yeah, those two moments for me really filled me with a lot of love about the like the stories that you can find with the average person. Like, it's like, well, there's a lot of incredible stories just around the corner. Like, literally, to people that you're engaging with, they actually have really great stories, and you should really, I don't know, start engaging with that because it's awesome when you do. So yeah, I think honestly, the community, the people gave me my love for art. Like, it really did. I can't really think of a more impactful thing. And I also did some amazing things with the people at AGYU, the Art Gallery of York University, where they were awesome. They constantly did programming that felt community-based. right? They would have these spoken word poets come in. I've spoken a few times there, and I was like, wow, this is like, this gallery feels accessible. It feels like it's for people. and it really warmed my heart to our institutions. I did some work with HRA, Art Gallery of Ontario, the Youth Council, and they just kept going from there. Mm. Not my own apartment.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, you're like at the heart of your work is just love, empathy, people, you know, emotional openness, and growth, like development, which is beautiful, is really amazing. And like, finally, like, what does the future hold for you? Like, what, you know, you were speaking about this, your like new exhibitions coming up and continuing art school?
Yes, a great question. After my show, first international show, I came back in May. It pushed me with this desire to like be even more serious, which is such an interesting thing to come back with when you've done this huge milestone of your career. I was like, no, I can go so much further. Like, I love the people I met there. Like, I love, especially Berlin. I went to Berlin first. I loved engaging with these people. And I felt like my practice and my art did this for me. And I just want to return the favor to it by being so much more disciplined. And so I've been here and I've been like doing daily paintings. I've been working so hard to just sort of like, just do it. Like, just do the thing that I want to do. I think really that's all I'm focused on in this particular moment. Just like, let's just do the work.
I think that's fantastic. And I know that, you know, you are doing it. You will do it. I can't wait to see what the future holds for you. Thank you so, so much for talking with me today. I really, really enjoyed it.
No, this is wonderful. Yeah, I really appreciate. And yes, okay, you inspired me to continue my blogs because I was like, no one reads blogs anymore. But
it was great. It was really, really great. It really gave me, like an insight that I would not have had if I had read somebody's writing about your work.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I really do appreciate it. And Bob's your uncle. Well, do you want to do a cute little picture over the internet screenshot?
Yes.
All right. Just smile at the camera. Thank you for entertaining that.
Thank you for listening to With Open Mouths. I am your host, Carnita Lilla. Special thanks to our guest, Jaga Deliska, for speaking with us today. This podcast is produced by Danuta Seerhaus and Agnes Etherington Art Center in partnership with Queen's University's campus radio station, CFRC 101.9 FM. Episodes are edited and mixed by Chancellor Maracle. The music is composed by Jamil 3DN and produced by Elroy EC3 Cox III. Episodes of With Open Mouths are released monthly, and you can find them on Digital Agnes, CFRC's website, and on your favorite podcasting platform. If you like what you heard, please leave us a review and subscribe now so that you don't miss a single episode. We'll see you next time. You know, first people really look like pennies. This brown skin, this is what they envy. And the culture.